The Diesel Podcast.
Developing innovation in English as a second or other language.
Episode 71, how monolingual teachers can help ELLs.
Welcome to Diesel. This is episode 71. We are your hosts. I'm Brent Warner.
And I'm Michelle Reyes. Happy October.
More Halloween. we couldn't hold ourselves back last episode. Yeah. We're like jumping into it.
I mean, we talked about how Halloween starts in, well, August, because that's when you start seeing the stuff in the stores. And you've got the shades to match, or not shades, you've got frames to match.
The frames, the orange glasses,
And Iron Maiden.
I saw Iron Maiden the other night, and it was awesome. So, so I'm getting into the spirit on all levels here. also, Michelle, this weekend we are not there, but this is the Catiesel conference.
Yeah, we're not at Catiesel.
This is kind of unusual for both of us to not be. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you're in Texas.
It's usually well, yeah, but we usually make appearances one way or another.
I mean,
I've presented.
Yeah.
With you all the way from here.
Yeah, Catiesel's been like a big part of our lives, and this is the first time I think that we don't have any, I don't know, COVID stuff, I can't remember. I don't count like COVID and online conferences as real. but back in person, and so we're missing it, and I'm a little, slightly sad to
it's
not
kind of there. Like a, you know, it's a meetup of all the cool people you've met throughout the years and that you collaborate with online. And I'm sure that some of our listeners and friends and colleagues are there. So shout out to everyone who is at Catiesel 22 in Pasadena.
Yeah, for sure. So I hope everybody's enjoying, and please bring back and share ideas that you're seeing. Actually, I will say I did look at the session listing and it looks pretty cool. Like there's lots of stuff on equity, inclusion, there's
CRT.
CRT, yeah. So it's really... It does seem to have a big shift of focus and to really kind of help people understand the student experience and all of those types of things. So,
right.
I'm happy to see that. And I hope that the weekend goes well for everybody who's able to attend. So, Michelle, with that... speaking of kind of helping everybody out, understanding the student experience, all of those types of things, we're talking today about how monolingual teachers can help ELLs.
Right.
And you brought up this topic. Why was this interesting to you?
Well, that's because I read an article a couple of weeks back on EdSearch, and the article was how monolingual teachers can support English language acquisition for multilingual learners. Mm-hmm. And of course, I've always been fascinated by instructors who don't think the L1 or the students L1 should be used with emergent speakers. Mm-hmm. And not that everybody that I know or that I've met does this, but it just kind of reaffirmed the fact that, hey, and you don't have to know another language in order to support students who speak another language. So that's really, you know, as a language learner and as a language teacher now, that I always, become really aware of how I can use the students L1 or just I may not speak their language, but I can still help them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that article, when you shared that along with me too, it was pretty interesting because the author, she went into depth into it. You know, she talked really about like how that all, how do you want to say it? Like how her perspective as a monolingual teacher affected her teaching. And her name was Donna Neary, I think, Donna Neary. And we'll link to the article and we'll link to her Twitter on the show notes. But it was really interesting because she really talked about like, oh, okay, here I recognize that there are some things. And the key part of this was that, you know, she asked her student, she asked her students, what do you want me to know about you? And she said, I want my teacher to know I'm smart in Swahili. And it's like, and so that implies that the student feels that they are treated as they are stupid because they don't have the English language, even though they feel like they are smart. And like, it's an interesting thing to say, like, I'm smart in this language and I'm dumb in another language. And it's like, well, your cognitive capacities aren't relegated. Well, it probably gets pretty complicated, but they're not relegated to your language abilities alone, right? And so, interesting perspective here.
Yeah, and I'm sure that many of us have had times when students are so focused on getting the English right because they don't want their teacher to have to repeat or someone else to have to repeat, and then assume that they're, quote unquote, as I've heard my students say, dumb. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that, you know, it hurts when you hear that.
Yeah, for sure. And so it was that kind of sent me down a little bit of a rabbit hole and sent you down too. We found a couple of things. There's even a book out there, which was really fascinating. And Michelle, we looked at this. We didn't read the whole thing, but we looked through parts of it. It's called The Plurilingual TESOL Teacher: The Hidden Languaged Lives of TESOL Teachers and Why They Matter, right? And that's written by Elizabeth Ellis in 2016. And it
So us post our instruction as you know, TESOL students. I wish I'd had this book back then.
Yeah, for sure. Because it really gets into, we have to say this out front because I don't want people to feel like attacked or anything. I mean, this book is clearly in favor of ELTs having experience with a second language and kind of makes arguments that, you know, having your own language acquisition history and the will have better effects on your teaching as a language teacher. That's really what they're, you know, what's happening behind this conversation here. And that's not to say that you, as you mentioned before, Michelle, that doesn't mean you can't have, be a good teacher if you only speak, I know amazing teachers who don't have a second language, but at the same time, this is just kind of making an argument for, a lot of times in our field, we distinguish things like non-native English speakers versus native English speakers. So there's the NEST subcategory that you'll find in like TESOL organizations, right? N-N-E-S-T, the non-native English speaking teachers, I think is what it is, right? So for example, you're born and raised in China, but you become an English language teacher. You might have, you know, some language issues even as you're teaching, and that's what that is, right, as compared to the native English speaker. But this one kind of categorizes it differently. It's saying, well, let's not focus on someone being non-native versus someone being native. Let's focus on that actually as a potential benefit, where it's like,
so it's an additive type rather than lack mentality here.
Exactly So it's saying, hey, let's look at groups of people who are you know, she calls it plurilingual, bilingual or more, right? Versus those who are monolingual, right? And so it's a shift in paradigm, right? On how you're approaching the conversation of like what it means to be a teacher or what different groups of teachers need different kinds of support. And I thought that's a really fascinating approach because it's, you know, after the conversations with JPB and all of these things, it's like, well, what direction are we centering the way that we're looking at this, right? And this might be another way to kind of help broaden their perspective. And so I wanted to read a couple of quotes from here, Michelle, and I'm not sure if there are any parts that stood out to you, but we'll kind of chat through them. So this kind of came at the end, but I'm putting it at the beginning because I think it sets up the context here. It says, a major finding here was that plurilinguals appeared to see L2 learning and L2 learning and use as unexceptional, achievable, and routine, whereas the discourse of monolinguals represented L2 learning in negative ways, referring to failure, incompetence, shyness, and embarrassment, right? So they're saying, hey, teachers who have who have gone through the process, they're like, yeah, it's doable, right? And other people are talking about like, oh, they're shy, oh, they're failing for this reason or whatever else it is, right? So it's how are you actually approaching the understanding? And again, I'm pretty confident anybody listening to this show is an active learner. And so I don't necessarily think that applies to our listeners or people who are actively like trying to become better in the field. But I think we do want to open up this conversation to people who recognize, oh, my colleague is approaching things in this way. And how can we have conversations about that? Right. And I think that's kind of where I'm a little like, it can be a sensitive topic, right? if people feel like, wait a second, I have this and, you know, whatever else it is. But I'm going to continue on a little bit here. So Some of the differences they showed, it said plurilinguals illustrated their answers with references to languages they spoke or had studied to make structural or pragmatic contrasts with English, in contrast to monolinguals who made less frequent, vaguer references, usually based on hearsay, to the ways in which English might differ from the learner's L1 and thus present challenges. What do you think about all that?
That actually reminds me of when our language students come into the class and then they're facing other cultures. Mm-hmm. And now they'll say like, oh, I heard that in your language, blah, 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 because they've never studied. Right.
Right.
And it may not be English in particular, but they're not, you know, they don't have any connection to that language. Whereas a student who has, for example, an Arabic speaker who has studied Italian will now be able to tell you, well, I now that I'm here in America, I'm seeing a lot of Spanish words that are very similar to Italian, and now they're able to make that reference. So this is the first thing I think of when I'm thinking of this. I, in my field, I haven't come upon many monolinguals. Mm. Most of the colleagues I have studied or lived abroad in one way or another. And so they're at least have some reference to maybe Spanish or German, mm-hmm. as that's often something that maybe even French.
Yeah, for sure. There's all sorts of different levels of experience. And this was the other thing too, is like we were talking in the pre-show that we don't want to necessarily define for you, the listener,
our audience,
or for your colleague, right? Like,
what is
I'm telling you that you're bilingual or you're not bilingual because you're hitting this, you know, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, listeners and teachers can determine for themselves whether they consider themselves at some level of plurilingualism or bilingualism or whatever it is. For my own personal experience, so as I was going through my language learning and kind of becoming fluent in Japanese, I could feel it, right? Like there were specific days and specific times when I'm like, oh, like my brain has suddenly kind of gotten over this hump, and I'm at a level where I really feel like there's much more fluency going on, right? And I have memories of the specific days and times when I'm like, oh, I just said something all in Japanese without thinking about it in English first, right? Like, and it was like, a, you know, not just like a word or two, but like a whole like communication, right? And then I also had the same, in the same span of time, I was starting to have my first dreams where I was like waking up and having dreams completely in Japanese, right? And so, so you have some of these indicators as a language learner of like when you think maybe mm-hmm. you're getting to fluency, or at least I did for myself. Yishel, I know you were younger than me during your language learning experience, but how did you feel in your transition?
In terms of English, so my first language is Spanish. In terms of English, I don't think there ever was a time. Mm-hmm. I was too young, I think, to even know. But I did know that I didn't understand anything, that I constantly felt blind. Mm-hmm. If that's when I look at it, it's like a chunk of stuff that I couldn't really understand and I was following or repeating. And then at some point in high school, certain things made sense, but I wasn't necessarily noticing anything like dreams or anything. However, when I started learning other languages, what I realized was I would practice in one language, just regular conversation, and then suddenly a word I couldn't remember in that language would pop into my brain in another language, and it was like I was mixing three, but my brain was just trying to communicate in whatever it was the easiest, most retrievable method. Mm. And I never was able to become trilingual. It just words pop, like when I'm in Japan, a word may pop up in Spanish because my brain's trying to retrieve the one that it's used the most. And then sometimes it'll pop up in sign language. Yeah. And that's the weirdest thing. And it's like, what?
That's a super interesting phenomenon, yeah. Which could be its own whole separate conversation.
Yeah.
My wife was giving me a hard time because we went to Mexico a couple of years ago and I was trying to pull up my old dusty Spanish, like, and then like Japanese words just kept on coming out. Yeah. She's like, why are you saying all these Japanese words? And I'm like, it's just my brain's just mixing these things up, right?
Your
like,
brain is being efficient at communication.
So absolutely it's part. So just a couple other points inside of this, you know, from the book here. It was interesting because they were interviewing different people who considered themselves monolingual, some who considered themselves plurilingual. And they said This is one study or one kind of case study that they did. Mm-hmm. Of the seven teachers who did not nominate language or cultural or language related experience as a key driver of their teaching philosophy, so something that helped them understand how to teach a language, five were monolingual. So it says out of the seven who didn't say that this was one of the things, five of them were monolingual. And so so it does seem true to say that monolingual teachers are less motivated to join the profession through language related experience. It goes on to say, this is entirely in keeping with the principle that underpins the plurilingual language acquisition. And man, the artificial intelligence is going to have a real hard time with transcribing this. So I'm going to have to do a lot of editing. So plurilingual language acquisition is a store of language riches, research of varied size and quality. And the larger and richer the store, the more experiences are available to enrich the teacher's repertoire. So it's really interesting to say, like, hey, the more language learning experience you have, the more you have to bring forward to the classroom experience, right? Mm-hmm. And again, to be clear, that's not discounting the quality of the other teachers. It's just saying, like, hey, I'm coming in with this richer background. So again, it's trying to encourage, if you're a non-native English speaker, you actually have huge benefits that you're bringing into this, and not to be not to consider yourself as a as a lesser than. And this has been a long conversation in our field, right, where non-native right. English speakers and non-native English speaking teachers have really felt kind of marginalized, or, you know, like not like they're not getting the opportunities that mm-hmm. native English speakers have, even though they have in these ways much richer experiences too.
You know, Brent, this brings to mind a couple of just memories of students who have come to me and felt frustrated that their own instructors were treating them like they didn't know anything because they weren't able to express themselves in English. Mm. And I've had, you know, students who come and tell me, adult students who come and tell me, in my country, I am this and this and that, and this is what I do there. But the instructor treats me like I don't know anything. Mm-hmm. And that, again, as a teacher, if you feel like if you're not paying attention to how that native tongue enriches the knowledge of that student and the strategies that they have already, how that enriches their ability to learn a language, then you're missing out on a whole trove of, I think the book calls it precious gems, right?
Right, right.
And that's true. I think for me as a language student, I remember thinking, oh, I don't have to study for the spelling test because all of these words are so similar to Spanish and nobody knows. And I wouldn't study because a lot of them were cognates. Sure. And now, of course, now the approach has shifted to recognizing those gems that the student does bring to the classroom. And if someone had told me, hey, because you speak Spanish, look at how much you bring to the table, or like, I would have maybe felt more pride in Spanish, in knowing Spanish, rather than trying to hide it and trying to blend in and trying to look like, hey, I speak English, I'm just shy.
Yeah, for but, sure.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, and I would say also, like, I have mixed feelings about this because I'm also sitting there thinking, well, I only know one language and in my particular, or one other language, right? My Japanese is strong, but like most of my students aren't Japanese, right? They're coming from other languages. And so there's a part of me where I'm also like, oh, well, I would be able to serve my Chinese speaking students so much better if I also had studied more Chinese, or my, you know, my Farsi speaking students, if I had studied any Farsi, right? And so I know this is like kind of being silly and too hard on myself for sure. But at the same time, it's like, oh, when you have those broader experiences, then you can talk more to the cultural issues and all the other things that also help. And so it can be, it just changes perspectives. It gives you different ways. And so I know there's a lot more inside of this book. And like you said, I do wish that we had read it as part of our grad school program, but mm-hmm. it's out there, it's available to look at. But Ishel, I know you also were looking at this different article that had a few points that were worth discussing.
Yeah, well. And I think before I move on to how monolingual teachers can help support language learners, I wanted to suggest that for those people who don't have the time to go learn another language, there there's a book I'm reading right now. And it's, again, I've studied quite a few languages, but this is illuminating so much that I think it would have benefited me even without knowing more about languages. And it's called The Culture Map. Decoding How People Think, Lead, and Get Things Done Across Cultures. It's by Aaron Meyer, and it's fascinating. It talks about, you know, just a lot of the ways that we perceive how someone communicates, of course, is going to be related to where we are in terms of the world and in geography. But it helps you to communicate in a way that you understand what are the values of that society. And if you understand the values of that society, then you're able to communicate better and not say, oh, because they're from an Asian country, they're quiet and shy. and so a lot of that, you see patterns like that, but it helps you to say, well, they value the, you know, there's a value there. And so I think that this is another good read, just to tag along on the topic of, if you don't have time to go learn other languages, you can learn about cultures and it's tied to language. So,
yeah.
So how can monolinguals, help out?
So your coffee just went whoosh, right? So you need another
16 ounces. So I read an article called Promoting and Maintaining Promoting and Maintaining Bilingualism and Biliteracy, Cognitive and Biliteracy Benefits and Strategies for Monolingual Teachers. And this was by Deborah Giambo and Tunde Seshi. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it's a 2015 article in the Open Communication Journal. And so we were talking about, okay, so how can, what strategies can teachers use in their classroom, especially ones that are monolingual teachers? How can they support bilingualism and biliteracy? And so in this article, I want to read a quote here. Research on the effectiveness of bilingual programs in relation to emerging bilingual children's literacy performance suggests that English language learners whose HL, and HL is defined as a heritage language, whose HL is supported, outperform peers who are placed in English-only immersion programs.
Dang.
Yeah. Okay. So dual immersion. And again, if you've been in a dual immersion program, many times there's one teacher who's a monolingual, and then there's another teacher who teaches the content in another language. Mm-hmm. So you have a monolingual teacher often, or a teacher just in charge of teaching that subject in one language.
Right. And I'm just going to quickly pause here, Ishel, because, you know, as you're talking about dual immersion, we know that a lot of our listeners are probably straight up, you know, ESOL at some level teachers. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. But this conversation really helps with the dual immersion, or, you know, the co-teaching model, or even mm-hmm. if you're a content area teacher and you mm-hmm. have language learners in the class, right? And so again, for people listening going, oh, this might be beneficial to, you know, to talk to this friend or this colleague about it as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so again, most obviously the dual language programs happen in the early elementary school grades up until I think the later elementary onto middle school. And then, you know, students usually go on to travel to the country of the language they learned. But another study quoted in this article says that Spanish-speaking and Cantonese-speaking second graders in transitional bilingual classrooms had equal or better scores on English decoding and reading comprehension measures than monolingual English-speaking children. Furthermore, an analysis of literature discussions that focused in read-alouds in English in a fifth-grade transition bilingual program examined the effects of a teacher's responsiveness to students' linguistic and cultural resources, for example, allowing code switching, and these practices resulted in students' efficient use of comprehension and metalinguistic and vocabulary strategies. Mm. So talking about cognates and using the L1 as a support, absolutely. You do not have to know about that language. You can just sit there, you know, allow the student to explain, or allow the student to talk it out in their own, in their HL heritage language or L1. By the way, this is the first time I've heard HL.
Yeah, me too.
So let's go ahead and transition and talk about strategies that teachers can use, in particular if you happen to be a monolingual.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so as always, we do appreciate everybody listening to the show. We're going to throw this out there. We talked about this before, but if you're looking for a consultation or training at your institution, we are opening a limited number of slots, kind of, you know, more on what's our capacity to be able to have time for. But if you're interested to have us help you or your team develop better ways to interact with your students, please feel free to reach out to both or either of us. And of course, depending on your needs and our availability, we would love to talk some details.
All right, so let's talk about the strategies that we can implement into our classrooms. And many of these were mentioned in that article that we mentioned right before the break. Mm-hmm. But a common one, well, for me, it seems like kind of common sense, but I don't know if it sounds like common sense, but reading in two languages, presenting a story in two languages. And that doesn't mean that the teacher has to know the language that you know, that's being shared. There may be a student who speaks that language and can't and is literate in that language. Oftentimes I've had students who will say, oh, we have the same fairy tale in Arabic. It's a little different, but, and then they'll talk to each other. You know, the Arabic speaking students will share with each other and then they'll translate to me what the differences are. But that accesses the knowledge that students already have, right? So reading in two languages.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. We also talk a little bit about summarizing in two languages, so it kind of connects the same type of idea. And it's interesting, you know, this is challenging me a little bit because we do our novel reading in my academic reading class, and like, and we're always like, don't read it in your L1, read it in your read it in English, right?
And the opposite.
Well, yeah, and it's like, but I still struggle with it because like you also like behavior wise, like you can talk about the ideal situation, but then you also get, you know, just natural behavior of students who have things. It's like, well, I'm just gonna read the,
you don't want to have the crutch, right?
Yeah, right.
Like, so if they don't need it, you want to empower them and to be autonomous and try to take the risk in the language that they're learning.
Right. But at the same time, kind of depending, and again, if you give those students the autonomy to make their own decisions, then, and hopefully they're making good decisions, right? Then some of these things are really valuable. So summarizing, right? We've talked many times about like how Google Docs has translation options. Moat, we've talked about. So if you're doing the audio notes inside of, you know, documents, and then Moat does automatic transcription and changes as well. So you can have different ways of communicating what you're trying to do in multiple languages. And that's and hopefully at the same time kind of building the links between the two languages, right? So that you're actually, or those students are building their language skills too, right? Their English language skills at the same time.
Yeah, I think Brent, when we talk about implementing these strategies, I think it's also important to mention that not all of these strategies don't have to be implemented all the time. Mm-hmm. So if you're the main meat of your course is that novel, there can be other instances where students do have a chance to summarize other things that are not, you know, the ultimate assessment piece, right?
Sure.
So you know, thinking about that as we go through these strategies. Also the systematic use of cognates and false friends, right? False cognates. So teaching those that are not related can actually help a student understand and access the new language faster, and also helps them to become aware of those, right? As they're learning, a lot of science or history texts lend themselves to decoding those cognates. Mm-hmm. So that also accesses what the student already comes with, right? And you I had someone recently ask me, again a student said, oh, I'm learning all of these, so the student's studying oceanography and those types of concepts of biology and geology and geography as they relate to the ocean, and he's studying the prefixes, and he said, does everybody know these in English? And I said, well, we study them, but we study, you know, we study them in K through 12. And again, understanding that Because he learned a little bit of Spanish. So he said, oh, and I've seen this one in Spanish, so I know what it means. And I said, yeah. So, but again, once you access what that student already comes with, or when we say their HL or their native language, then you're taking that and using it as a tool.
Yeah. And so that also connects to this idea of like, it's okay to promote writing in their own language as well, right? So, in home or shared in a class, right? So a lot of times I do smaller levels of this, again, since my students are getting more advanced, that you might kind of, again, depending, you're going to have to look at your own situation, but you might kind of scale this, right? Like, hey, we're going to do this more as they're kind of, you know, beginner level. And as they get more advanced, we're going to start making some transitions and challenging people to, you know, to push themselves, right? But I also say, like, hey, if there's a single vocabulary word and you have a quick single one transition word, you know, one word that you can put in the side notes to help you remember what that word is, you know, just put it in your own language. It's okay to leave notes and annotations for yourself, right? Again, we want students to become autonomous language learners, and some of those, you know, a lot of teachers have gotten so kind of into the concepts of things that it's like, hey, we do learn vocabulary words just by translating the immediate vocabulary word. Like, that is a real thing. And it's okay to encourage that sometimes when it's appropriate for the setting.
Yeah. And it, again, it just depends on when you're applying the strategy. It doesn't mean you have to do it every single day. For those of us who only teach 1 hour classes or 2 hour segments every, you know, every other day, you might have, okay, at the, you know, the last day of the class or the second week of the month, we do this language bit where we're talking about all the languages, right? Mm-hmm. And again, that's still promoting, and it helps other students who aren't familiar with the cultures or the languages of those language learners.
Yeah. And I just want to add real quickly in here, when I see my students annotating and putting, like, you know, let's say they put the Spanish word next to the word, that to me is an indication that they're reading and trying to figure out what's going on, right? Like, that's a really good sign to me when I look, when I'm like, hey, let's check out your book. Let's check out, if you know, I like to have my students do actual physical annotation on the paper book. And so, so I'll say, like, let's take a look at what you're actually doing. And it's like, oh, like, very cool. Like, I can see that you're like trying to figure this out. Sometimes I'll see like my students, so I don't read Chinese, right? But I'll see students and they'll have like, I can tell where the characters end, and they'll have like slashes between them, right? So they're giving like two or three different Chinese synonyms, words to kind of match up with the one English word. And I'm like, that to me is a real sign of like progress and thinking and trying to figure out the nuance of the word, even though I don't speak their language, right? And I can't read whatever's going on. I still have a sense as the teacher, and I'm going, hey, I don't have your language, but I can see that you're doing the work and that you're putting it in and trying to figure out what's going on. So that's a great way too.
Yeah, another strategy is creating dual language versions of something. So whether it's an article and you're able to find it in another language, or asking the students to create that version in another language. We talked a little bit about this in episode 64 with Jen Giffen. She talked about how she would have students come in and put greetings in different languages, and the language that was missing, a student knew would know how to do it, and she would have them write it. And that's just like, I want to say, like, just a tiny version of what you could be doing. But you could be now using Book Creator or something else to have to create a dual language version of whatever it is you're reading, and then these in turn can become part of the classroom library or part of a classroom, I don't know, binder, where you have all of the versions for further sharing.
Right. Yeah. So I like that idea, right? They can, if that becomes a part of a collection, right? And you're kind of seeing what students are doing, that's amazing.
Yeah. And it you know, shows the value of students' literacy skills in more than one language.
So another thing, you know, you could do is dialogue journals in two languages, right? And again, you're balancing this out, but your students can use their HL/L1 for journaling, right? And they can, then the the teacher can give them key vocabulary words in English, right? And then the students can then go in and say, well, hey, I'm going to write part of this in English. Or maybe they're going to start themselves off by just getting their ideas going in their language, and then they're going to try and switch it over into English, right? And there are a lot of cool tools. Michelle, I know you have a couple of ideas to kind of encourage. And again, remember, I want to be clear with this. Like, we're encouraging bilingualism through this process, mm-hmm, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's an additive
process rather than what do they call it? There's another word, subtractive. I don't know.
removative process. But this is what I want to kind of encourage, because I think for a lot of, for even for me, like, I'm sitting here kind of saying these things, and I'm saying, wait a second, but they're not prioritizing English. And it's like, no, they're prioritizing bilingualism. Right? They're mm-hmm. prioritizing learning the a second language, which is why I don't have a problem with ESL, English. I don't have a problem with that term, because it's a second language to me. I know a lot of other people have other issues with it, but for me, it's a second language. And so if we're saying, hey, we want you to have your first language and we want you to have your second language, and then if you're kind of positioning yourself, not as the teacher, I am the L1 speaker, but actually I am their L2 speaker, right? Or whatever mm-hmm. it is. That's a different way of, framing it, and a different perspective on the way you're approaching talking to them about their learning and about their the way that they're getting their language.
Yeah, and I think I want to go back to my recent experience in Japan, working with trying to help students comprehension skills mm-hmm. and ability to summarize in English. And I'm now thinking, hey, I was doing this, even though I didn't realize I was doing this. Obviously, we were in Japan, the country of their native language, so it made it harder for them to speak in English. But if I had asked the students, hey, we're going to only now write in English, we're only going to speak about this, whatever I showed you or shared with you in English, I think that would have been really difficult for them and intimidating, mm-hmm. because I was the English speaker, right?
Right.
And they're the ones learning, and so they may not be as willing to share. And I would constantly tell them, okay, we're going to listen to this piece, or we're going to read this piece. We're going to stop now. Now I want you to turn to a partner and I want you to explain it to each other in Japanese. And they'd look at me. I said, yep, only Japanese right now is your chance. So take it. And then they would, I could, see whether they understood. And then they would start asking me questions, clarification questions in English. And then they would go back to Japanese. So they were piecing together the things that they understood. And then we'd have the discussion in English, right? But now we could fill in the pieces. And this is exactly what we were doing here. We didn't do dialogue journals, but I'm thinking back now to one of the ideas of summarizing in another language. Mm-hmm. And then I guess you could be doing this with Book Creator, where you might pair students up and have them do the English version and their own language version. You don't have to focus on their own language version first if you're targeting English. But again, it's bilingualism, right? It's both of them.
Right.
You could share them in the class. You could do Google Docs for sentences if you're focusing on smaller chunks of text, or you can use video as well. Flip, right? Mm-hmm. Those could be dialogue journals. Students can comment to each other in another language. I mean, of course, you have to have some parameters or something like, okay, well, if we're going to write it in that language and then write it in English. Mm-hmm. So you're still translating, but you're still practicing in English as a target language.
I like the idea. Now, just thinking of this, like, mm-hmm. again, if you did something like Flip, and then one student was responsible for telling a short story, like I like the fairy tales thing, right? Mm-hmm. Or a tall tale or something like that in their language. And if you have a more unified group where more people understand, where everybody kind of understands the HL, I guess we're going to call it here, then mm-hmm. the second person responding to that could be the one who's responsible for trying to translate it, right? And then you're each person's responsible for trying to translate their other classmate's story, right? And so you can choose the one. You can communicate clearly for yourself in your own language, but then you're also going to say, hey, I'm going to play around with this and I'm going to try to translate. And so you're getting both sides of it at the same time.
Right. And I think it's really important for students, especially in classrooms where you've got multiple ethnic groups or different languages spoken or even regions, right, to have these conversations or materials available that are student created or experiences that are student focused, because you're also helping those who are not of the same region or the same language, et cetera, to understand the inclusivity of and the richness of and the value of all of these differences. And I think that's just so important. And how many chances do we actually get to try and infuse our lessons with some of this? Is very, we don't have a lot of time, but you can do it, and it is possible.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then another strategy, I do need more coffee. Another strategy is to engage in sister class projects that involve students who speak different languages, maybe from different countries, working together on creating literature and art that can serve to enhance the literacy skills in both languages. And I think, Brent, this reminded me of your project where you have, I think, I don't remember if it was Funny and Farsi or if it was The Alchemist, and students had to do projects using Adobe Video or Adobe Spark, one of them.
Yeah.
And I could easily see this one as being one where you could now have someone go in there and talk, you know. You could extend it to culture, et cetera. But this one would be one where you could have groups, you know, creating their version in their language,
right,
and
right.
in their HL, and having art that represents that with both languages, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
This just reminded me of that.
Yeah, so there's all sorts of cool things that you can do here. And again, this is, to me, it's really about the paradigm shift about like trying to say like, hey, I'm not trying to bring you, you know, like I'm not trying to make you an English speaker. I'm trying to support you in your bilingual growth, right? Or
right.
plurilingual growth or whatever that is. And so
plurilingual,
you know, like it does not flow off the tongue. It kind of drips out at the side of the mouth. But yeah, so again, like all of these things. So for many of us who are, you know, maybe who don't speak all the languages or don't even have a second language, like these are great approaches to kind of recognize some of the things that maybe those who do speak a second language as teachers, right, like might already be implementing or might already kind of recognize at a fundamental level, even though it might not necessarily be explicit for everyone. But then they're kind of going, well, wait a second, these strategies actually do help, and I've seen them for myself in my own growth. I've seen them through, you know, the processes of how I teach, right? Even though other teachers kind of maybe choose not to do those types of things. And so, so I don't think any of these individual things are necessarily like, hey, this is mind-blowing, you know, a mind-blowing approach to things. But at the same time, we kind of want to be able to validate and say, hey, maybe different ways of doing this work really can make a difference in our class for our students.
Right. All right, it is time for our fun finds. Hey. And today I have water llama. What is a water llama?
What is a water llama? I do not know.
Well, it is an app.
Okay.
And as some of you know, I run. I do a lot of running. And living in a warm state, it is important. Actually, it is always important to stay hydrated. And one way that you can do is by creating your custom intake, water intake, and then getting reminders on Water Llama. It is free. It is a very simple app, and it's just got cute little avatars that you get your llama, and your llama fills up with water, and then you collect these little avatars. But it just helps you to keep track and be more aware of your water intake.
How does it know how much water you drink? Do you have to
input.
To swallow a microchip and then it just measures the water that it comes in your stomach or something?
No, you drink a glass of water and then you click drank one glass of water.
Oh, well, that's not
and
very,
then of course you can
very modern.
But it's got the cute water llama, so the water llama.
It's very cute, yes.
Okay. It's also an app based in Ukraine, so I'm supporting. You can get the little avatar with the Ukraine flag.
Cool. All right. So mine is when I was growing up, in Christmas, we always had like the little Dickens villages, you know, like on the the fireplace mantle.
Yeah.
I don't know if you had those or not.
Yeah, I've seen them.
Yeah, so I grew up with those and they were always cool. Some of them were cheaper and some of them were better, but we had some of those as a kid. And then I was like, you know, fine. I just found that there is a company called Lemax who makes a lot of these things, Lemax, L-E-M-A-X, and they have a whole set of towns called the Spooky Town Collection, which essentially is the Halloween version of the Dickens villages. And so it's like, you know, like all these like the spooky pumpkin patch and the, you know, the zombies coming out of the graveyard and like all of these cool things and like, and these thematic like, go to the apothecary, like those types of things. And so I saw this thing. It looks like they're available at Michael's or, you
know, they're also available on Amazon.
And Amazon.
So I just looked them up and I was wondering, how does one go about finding out that there's a Spooky Town collection? How did you come upon this?
The internet, Ishel.
But I mean, were you just randomly Googling Halloween decor or?
No, I wasn't. So I follow this girl on Twitter and I can't remember her name right now. But
the social medias.
The social medias, yeah. And she's like she does these like she makes these custom bookends, and so they're like these little, I don't know if you've seen this type of thing before, but basically like she makes these super miniature video shops of like old Blockbuster videos or old horror themed like a little diorama set that goes in your bookshelf and is meant to go between books. And you can kind of light it up. So anyway, she does all these cool things. I'll find her name and I'll put the link in the show notes. But she's like, she mentioned, you know, hey, I've got my Lemax decorations Spooky up. Town. I'm like, what's that? And so I started looking.
So if you don't do Christmas, if you don't do Christmas, but you're a big Halloween fan, this is so another way you can do it.
Totally. Yeah. So it's like Halloween decorations.
Sounds like me. I totally do this.
I'm going to go to Michael's right after this show and buy my first one. And then what I always liked when I was a kid, my mom used to do was she would buy one a year, you know, so it'd be like, how you're adding to the collection and you're kind of going on. And so it becomes
that's
just like
fun.
A little bit of a tradition.
That's just fun.
Yeah.
That's
and fun. So I'm like, and it looks like they do seasonal ones maybe every year, like new ones come out. And so I'm going to just maybe start building a little, a Spooky Town collection for myself. And that is my fun find.
So on the heel of International Podcast Day, which was September 30th. Yeah. We want to say thank you for supporting the show.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, you can always leave us a shout out with a review on Apple Podcasts, or if you're giving us a shout out any other way, tag us on social media. We're on all the platforms.
We're out there.
We're out there.
Yeah, so we also have Patreon, or buy us a coffee if you'd like to, at diesel.org. Show notes for this episode are at diesel.org/71, and you can listen to us at Voice Ed Canada. That's voiced.ca. As Twitter was mentioned before, the show is at Diesel Pod, and I am at Brent G. Warner.
And I am Ixie Pixie at Ixie_PI. Well, sorry,
I'm Ixie underscore.
Ixie underscore
spell
Pixie.
That out.
Hi, Michelle at Ixie underscore Pixie. That's IXY underscore PIXY.
Hey.
All right. In Serrano, thank you is Hakupa'ai. So Hakupa'ai for tuning in to the Diesel Podcast.
Hakupa'ai.